Pluto's fleas regularly stole the show, parachuting off Pluto when he scratched. Disney animators were instructed to make Pluto's character that of a real dog with just enough exaggeration to make him a comic. Pluto might show real bravery when Mickey is in danger. Otherwise, his courage is 90% bluff. He might be described as a likable coward. No two better words describe a domesticated dog. A Los Angeles Illustrated Daily News piece from 1931 called Pluto the dumbest actor in the world. This quote came not from a disgruntled fan, but from Disney's own PR office. The article included a Pluto origin story. He bumbled into a Disney gag meeting, knocking over buckets of paint and colliding with swinging doors. "Why, this pup is too dumb to live," one writer said. "He's exactly what we have been looking for," Walt said. "People will howl over his dumbness on screen." It's a joke, but it's still wounding to have Pluto's creators pass him off as not possessing a single human attribute in the way of intelligence. Walt wanted the best-looking animation in the world, which meant the best-moving. Call it the Pluto Principle. Dogs should move like dogs, act like dogs, and acting wasn't something that could be easily captured in a single pose. Still life was not life. If only there was a way to teach artists how to capture movement. This idea led to Walt's fabled involvement with the Chouinard Art Institute. Walt had personally chauffeured men to and from classes since the watershed year of 1929. By 1932, he started bringing teachers to the studio for what he called the Disney Art School. The animators rebelled at first. No mean feat when what they were rebelling against was ogling nude models. But they eventually knuckled down and stopped drawing bawdy Mickey Mouse comics during class. Working at Disney was an education. The Disney staff grew exemplary at capturing animal movements on film. In a few short years, they had reached new heights of verisimilitude. Norm Ferguson drew a bit with Pluto caught in flypaper that regularly gets listed as the all-time finest bit of pure animation. And it wasn't just dogs. Every animal was a new case study for the Pluto Principle. How did ducks waddle differently from chickens? How did cows trot differently from mules? Sound was a solved problem, but there was still much to learn in the simple act of locomotion. Disney's stable of animals kept growing, but one beast resisted capture. Man. The rare humans who showed up in silly symphonies such as Mother Goose Melodies looked like puppets, far less real than a mouse. More work would be needed if Walt ever wanted to tell a human story. But who needed humanity when you had Mickey Mouse? The Mickey comic strip had become better than anyone dreamed. Mouston was vibrant and alive, his Mickey a perfect mix of humble and hero. Walt liked Floyd's take on Mickey so much, he made them the model sheets for Mickey's screen artists. To drum up publicity for the strip, Floyd Gottfredson offered readers an autographed picture of Mickey. This, he figured, would activate readers, plus put pressure on newspapers to start running the strip. For a week, Mickey joked about getting ready for his big portrait. Each strip included a note to send to your local paper, a self-addressed stamp envelope for a replica of a Mickey Mouse painting suitable for framing. The painting even had a joke, since one of Mickey's friends was photobombing it. Over 20,000 letters poured in over the next few weeks. A picture of the mailvalanche was attached to a press release, which claimed this was merely par for the course for Hollywood's tiniest celebrity. Walt got his death of Mary Gold moment. But one moment was enough. "Let's get publicity, but for God's sake, don't do that again," he lightheartedly scolded Floyd. Pluto the screen dog was officially introduced into the strip when he followed Mickey home from the circus. He would become so popular he would graduate to his own screen series in 1931, Pluto the Pup. For the first time, an animal was the star of a funny animal cartoon. "Mickey Mouse has a bigger screen following than 9/10 the stars in Hollywood," Luella Parsons wrote in 1931. "And what better name for a star's companion than a planet? In the comics, the screen, and the heavens, Pluto was here to stay. Chapter 24. Merch Madness, 1932. The Literary Digest asked boys in 1931 what they wanted to be when they grew up. The top three answers were cowboy, aviator, and soldier. Mickey Mouse had already been all three. Whatever new fad there was in the workaday world, a new ditty, a new dance number, a novel, a serial, or most of all a film, Mickey was there. And what he didn't cover was Sucker for the Sillies, Egyptomania, Chinoiserie, or Life in a Toy Store. Disney was inhaling culture and exhaling cartoons as fast as it could march, but even that did not seem to be fast enough. It needed so many gags, Walt hired Ted Sears, heading animation's first story department, to simply think them up. Other studios helped out by adding Mickey as a Wildcat cameo. The Fleischer brothers even had Betty Boop be serenaded with the song, Minnie the Moocher. Mickey was a hit with children all around the world, all except for Walt's empty abode. Walt found himself in the unusual company of J.M. Barrie, Beatrix Potter, Lewis Carroll, Curious George's Margaret and H.A. Ray, Amelia Bedelia's Peggy Parrish, C.S. Lewis, and Dr. Seuss. They were all childless children's superstars. Walt became a surrogate father when Lily's divorced sister moved in with her daughter, but he longed for a child of his own. He and Lily had tried for years, but Lily kept suffering miscarriages. "She seemed to have difficulty carrying them," Edna Disney remarked. "My trouble was getting pregnant. We only had one." All of this led Walt to, right around his 30th birthday, skirt a mental breakdown. Bob Thomas reports that Walt would snap at employees, go blank during meetings, and spend sleepless nights worrying about the fate of his studio. He needed a break, or else he would break. The studio survived without Ub, but could it last without Walt? Disney seemed self-sustaining with house directors and new house styles. Burt Gillett's style emphasized gags, which was in tune with Walt's vision for Mickey. Jackson's cartoons focused more on story, so he was a better fit for the symphonies. They would watch the shop. Walt planned a month-long vacation, but where should he and Lily go? And should they tell the staff? Toadying animators were known to accidentally vacation wherever Walt was. After ruling out Hawaii, Walt decided to head to St. Louis to board a Mississippi riverboat. But the Depression was approaching its third terrible year in the Midwest. Luxuries such as vacations were a thing of the past, and Walt and Lily couldn't find a riverboat, so they improvised a road trip. The sabbatical worked. Walt entered 1932 ready to build his company. Columbia's line of credit had saved Disney, but it was time to pay it back. The studio also had to pay a $150 bill because Walt never got rights to feature Turkey in the Straw and Steamboat Willie. Roy even managed to pay his and Walt's parents back the $2,500 they lent their sons in leaner days. This didn't mean Disney was out of financial trouble. Roy kept acquiring loans, smartly never using the company for collateral. Sometimes he didn't even tell Walt about the loans, for fear Walt would just spend the money. Pat Powers dropped a very unwelcome line offering to help. They turned him down quickly. Years later, a child would ask Walt what exactly he did, since he no longer drew or wrote. "Sometimes I think of myself as a little bee. I go from one area of the studio to another and gather pollen and sort of stimulate everybody. I guess that's the job I do." As animation historian Michael Barrier points out, Walt's truest job description was surrogate audience member, seeing the forest of entertainment through the trees of frame-by-frame animation. And as an audience member, Walt was growing tired of rubber hose animation. Rubber hose was the final artifact of the iWorks era. Bit by bit, it would all be replaced with a new style nicknamed stretch and squash. This new style made characters pliable as taffy. A pig that was stretched tall would become thin in the process. Volume in a sound cartoon used to mean loudness. Now it meant preservation of mass. This wasn't just change for change's sake, or because it had Iwerks' fingerprints on it. The Pluto principle called for an emphasis on realism. The closer animators hewed to real life, the better the end result. I definitely feel we cannot do the fantastic things based on the real unless we first know the real, Walt said in a memo. Stretch and Squash was a new mission statement. Cartoons had weight. Columbia Pictures' 2-year deal for Silly Symphonies was fulfilled with the 26th Silly, The Bird Store, released January 1932. Work on the Sillies took a 6-month break as Roy looked for a new distributor. Jack Sohn became a Mickey director starting with February's The Duck Hunt. With nose possibly brown, the cartoon featured the song Columbia, Gem of the Ocean. The special effect tricks of 1929, shadows, reflections, were commonplace 2 years later. Almost every shot now contained a special effect, as well as an abundance of characters and fewer bits of cycled animation. This perpetually raised bar kept Walt in financial limbo, but it also made for the best quality product. Columbia never much liked the Sillies, though. To quote the popular Ben Burney song of 1932, "What? No Mickey Mouse?" Columbia bundled Mickey cartoons with its less popular shorts. You had to buy a bill of goods if you wanted the big cheese. Roy was having his own problems with Columbia. Not enough Mickey Mouse promotion, and not enough of the assumed profits being shared. Walt had greased the wheels at United Artists for a while. In 1931, he produced a few seconds of dancing Mickey animation for a Doug Fairbanks travelogue film. Doug meets Mickey in, of all places, Siam. Fairbanks was one-third of United Artists, along with his wife Mary Pickford and Walt's idol, Charlie Chaplin. Now that Walt was as much a name as his mouse, he asked if they would be interested in the Silly Symphonies, at $15,000 per short. It was a bargain. The Sillies were more popular than any of UA's 2 real live-action comedies. Silly Symphonies would become UA's first cartoon. The deal was set, but Roy had to keep it quiet. For months, he negotiated with Columbia about upcoming contracts, even fielding a meeting with the third studio, Universal, all to camouflage the extant deal with UA. When Columbia execs eventually found out about UA, they promised that Disney would lose plenty in the final few months of their payments. Disney assuredly did. The UA deal allowed Walt to finally meet Charlie Chaplin. Chaplin, it turned out, was a Disney fan, and he requested Mickey Mouse shorts to run before his masterpiece, City Lights. The little tramp understood better than anyone how hard it was to build a lovable character through gags. He passed on advice to Walt that could serve as the unofficial Disney motto: own every picture you make. Owning the rights to Mickey was already benefiting Disney. Mickey Mouse was now licensed to appear on some products, a toothbrush holder here, a napkin there. This wasn't much income, but it took zero effort. Roy was underestimating the mouse's celebrity. Mickey Mouse was sitting on a gold strike, like the Klondike, the brand endorsement. Endorsements were usually political, where one office holder vouched for another. Occasionally, a public figure would get paid for testimony about a product, but most items in a factory showroom or a grocery store shelf sold themselves. Sure, they did so via dubious health claims, but at least that was germane. A cartoon character's appearance on a loaf of bread should have no sway with anyone above the age of 4. But it did. In 1904, the creator of the comic strip Rapscallion, Buster Brown, hawked over 200 licenses for Buster Brown merchandise at the St. Louis World's Fair. Over a century later, Buster Brown shoes are still sold, purchased by customers who have no idea Buster Brown was ever a comic strip character. In 1930, an Amos and Andy toy car was the Sears Roebuck catalog's mechanical toy hit. It was an absurd idea to pay for Skeezix from Gasoline Alley to appear on your bar of soap, but this was a time of oddities. The world's most popular movie star was a singing mouse. Walt Disney became the first robber baron of this new type of wealth, despite one Disney exec saying that Walt had almost nothing to do with it. It all began with a 1932 phone call from a Kansas City hat merchant named Herbert K. Kamen. Kamen represented the Little Rascals in KC and understood Mickey Mouse's popularity better than Walt himself did. Disney held the deed to an untapped oil well. Kamen had set up secret clubs for local boys, complete with a newsletter. The newsletter was a ploy to get boys' addresses and birthdays. Kamen would send their parents letters that birthdays were a great time to buy a new suit with matching shoes. Decades before such terms were invented, Kamen was a direct marketer, a data miner, a social engineer. Kay hustled himself into an interview at Disney. The man who showed up at the studio was a homely Harold Hill, a robust dandy with an enforcer's mug. He kept his hair pomaded and parted down the middle as straight as his suit's pinstripes. The meeting he took with Walt and Roy netted Kay an employment contract, which suggests a question. Could a man who was not a great salesman talk his way into the job? Many at the time called Kamen a con artist. As Kamen was to find out, the advertising world used all the mountebank's tools of the trade. A grifter had to skip town through the back door in the dead of night. A publicity man, though, was invited in via the front door day after day. It paid more to go straight. Kamen set to work proving his worth. His job was to pick up all the money he claimed Disney was leaving on the table by going national with his upselling tactics. Stock a Mickey Mouse product, his pitch went, and the marketing campaign was thrown in for free. In later decades, a whole thesaurus of words would be used to describe his actions. Brand ambassador, vertical integration, transmedia hype, worldwide non-exclusive licensing rights. Leveraging Mickey's press popularity would be availability bias, keeping Mickey in theaters would be default bias, and selling the mouse's reputation, the halo effect. Back in the 1930s, it was all just sales. Kamen never sold a single Mickey Mouse toy. What he sold was Mickey Mouse. Mickey was an idea, so much more than inked circles. Kids and adults believed in him by the millions. Just as a boy will unconsciously ape his older brother, consumers were more inclined to buy napkins or marmalade if Mickey was on it. Kamen became Mickey's ringmaster, his hype man. Kamen charged between 2.5% to 10% of each sale for Mickey, but customers were paying 100% for the little guy. Branding was not just for cattle anymore. Instead of taking the money and running, Kamen rode. He acquired a private rail car, bought a wardrobe right out of the brand new Esquire magazine, and took business trips around the world where he wined and dined in five-star style. But he never forgot who the boss was. Kamen's receptionist at New York's Rockefeller Plaza answered the phone not with K. Kamen or even Walt Disney, but Mickey Mouse. Cables were sent to the address Mick Mouse. On Kamen's stationery, Mickey's name was twice as big as Kamen's. And in red. That communion between audience and star was what was being sold to the Ingersoll Watch Company in 1933, which would soon expand its Connecticut business tenfold based on the success of Mickey Mouse watches. Mickey also kept what Forbes magazine called the proverbial wolf of bankruptcy away from Lionel Train's, thanks to its circus cars bearing Mickey's mug. Art historian Bevis Hillier says Mickey licensing also saved the factory town of Norwich, New York, when the Norwich Knitting Company started to make Mickey-branded clothing. That was what Kamen sold to makers of door knockers, coloring books, artwork, magazines, and ice cream cones. The experience Walt would later describe with the portmanteau, merchantainment. Disposable baubles for disposable incomes. Mickey's visage turned almost any consumable into a toy. Seemingly half the Mickey-branded toys would puzzle a modern child. Bagatelle, quoits, hurdy-gurdies, sparkers, tin litho wind-ups, slate dancers, parade sticks, jazzers. Yet they practically walked themselves out the door, even the ones that didn't wind up. The New York Times described it as a perpetual motion business cycle. The better the art of the Disney studio, the better the byproducts sell, and the better they sell, the better the art again. Cayman became merciless in his demand for product fidelity. Every Mickey and Minnie looked like they jumped off an animator's desk. These 20th century icons took places of honor in American homes, right next to the picture of the president or Timmy in his dress uniform or whoever was in Photoplay magazine. Cayman tied that religious impulse to commerce, turning fans into devotees. A better word still might be apostles. One ticket stub at a time, Mickey Mouse had progressed from screen idol to golden calf. One watch ad said, "Every boy and girl worships Mickey Mouse," next to a picture of children prostrate before a sun with Mickey's face on it. Strategies used to promote tyrants were being used to promote laundry soap, pop artist Douglas Coupland noted of this new age of pop art. In fact, there was a South African tribe that refused to purchase soap unless it had Mickey's face on it. The world developed a fetish for Mickey fetishes. The cross-pollination that worked so well for Mickey Mouse worked for other characters as well. As each new hero arrived on the market, The Shadow in 1930 from pulp novels, Dick Tracy in 1931 from comics, The Lone Ranger in 1933 from the radio, they soon grew too large for one medium. Dick Tracy gained a radio show. The Lone Ranger got both a Republic film series and a spin-off about his crime-fighting nephew, the Green Hornet. And who knows what evil lurks in the heart of men? Orson Welles knows. He voiced radio plays starring The Shadow. This amount of money rolling into Disney was life-changing. Some people would retire. Others would live lavishly or give it to charities. Walt chose to redirect the moolah holes right back at Disney, ensuring liquid assets for expansion and growth. He took little for himself, which made at least one star, Hedy Lamarr, one of the smartest people in Hollywood, to tell him that he really needed to start saving. "You might not always earn so much," she said. "That is impossible," Walt said. This magical thinking ensured Roy would spend years carrying debt he didn't have to. But it was Walt's company, and Walt was thinking big. If Walt thought small, he'd follow up the success of Mickey Mouse and Silly Symphony with a third serial. But Walt had bigger plans, plans to make Disney a household name above and beyond Mickey. Walt's first big thought was color. Mickey Mouse just started a Sunday color comic strip. What was good enough for newspapers was good enough for the big screen. Color, as iWorks found, presented technical, artistic, and financial challenges. Walt was paying for a 3-strip Technicolor license. Time to use it. Color wouldn't be easy, Roy pointed out to Walt. A palette of new paints would have to be developed for a color short. Off-the-shelf paints might dull or crack under the hot lights. Making and maintaining 7 different greens for weeks on end was a serious endeavor. Running off duplicates of the film with the right color balance would be a challenge, too. The cherry on top? UA wouldn't pay a cent extra for it. But Walt wanted to impress UA. Leading with his heart instead of his brain, Walt decided that the black and white silly his animators had halfway completed would be redone from scratch in color. Only God could make a tree, as the poem went, but only Walt could make that tree green and brown. Work began on inking every cell on the front, letting it dry, then painting swatches of color on the back. Everything that could go wrong did, beginning with scrapping thousands of bucks of finished black and white animation. Roy worried the paints might crack or dull. They did both. The painters had to concoct a new admixture that would dry without cracking. Each color had to have multiple letdown gradients, usually made by watering down paint and letting the mixture evaporate and reduce to be brighter in close-ups. To ensure the colors matched, they mixed vast quantities of each hue, more than they could ever use. With iWorks at the helm, these problems might have been conquered in a month. Without him, it took 6 months. Some of this was negotiating for a new contract, but mostly it was the 99% perspiration. One discovery, that red objects vibrated when placed against the green or blue background, became the basis for 1950-style 3D. Roy floated the idea of releasing the cartoon in black and white first, but Walt shot that down. Only Roy G. Biv would do. Even at a distribution cost of $12,000 for 200 color prints. The result, Flowers and Trees, was a celebration of nature like none before. The three-strip Technicolor was able to show subtleties lost in a sea of gray. Each tree was a different brown, with a darker hue striping its right side to show shadow. The content was no different than previous silly symphonies, dancing trees instead of dancing birds. But like a squinting man given glasses, everything looked beautiful and crisp. Flowers and Trees made people forget that Flip the Frog's Fiddlesticks ever existed. Vibrant details abounded. Jagged orange flames, light blue raindrops, oscillating leaves, and wavy puffs of smoke. For the first time, a rainbow looked like a rainbow. So what if the story was an old chestnut? An old chestnut was one of the leads. Flowers and Trees premiered at Grauman's Chinese Theater in July 1932. Sid Grauman himself asked to premiere it after scoping out production footage. It was a huge hit, as big if not bigger than a Mickey Mouse. UA couldn't have been happier. The cartoon may even have inspired the ants of Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. The next silly symphonies, Bugs in Love, was already started in black and white. Roy wouldn't let Walt be foolish enough to destroy two half-finished films, so that was completed as is. Starting with King Neptune, though, all new UA cartoons would be in color. Before the year was out, they'd have a color cartoon about an evil witch fighting dwarfs, Babes in the Woods, and A Christmas Tale, Santa's Workshop. The color increased UA's rentals, but that extra revenue would take years to manifest. And even then, Disney would only get a percentage. It takes patience to wait for such money to roll in. Roy's patience sometimes gets on my nerves, Walt would later say. But the quality of the work made Bank of America offer Roy a loan of enough money to continue cartooning in color and pay off other debts. This largesse also helped Walt build a mansion in Los Feliz. He and Roy still had family get-togethers most weekends, but they were no longer next-door neighbors. Color was also the first time a certain four-fingered mouse stopped feeling immortal. With each color silly symphony, it wasn't just Warner Brothers and Iwerks that looked inferior. Mickey, too, looked more and more like a child of the 20s. A dazzling new opening with his face zooming toward the screen helped, but it was still in black and white. It was a small matter, though, when Walt was playing an audience's funny bone like one of Mickey's ersatz instruments. In fact, a guffawing audience member would become Walt's next big star. The laugher was a talking dog with an uninhibited, "huh-yeah" chuckle that practically screamed, "Rube." The dog, voiced by Pinto Colvig, noisily chomped on a bag of peanuts while watching the show in Mickey's review. He had some scruff on his canine face and a hobo hat, but that "huh-yeah" was a winning character trait, recognizable and easily imitated. Walt had given the laugh to a cannibal king in Trader Mickey and smartly brought the goofy guffaw back. He was first called Dippy Dog, then the Goof, then finally Goofy. The Goof's dumbness is of a different type than Pluto's, Ted Sears told Disney animators. He is on the silly side and always harmless. He tries to do things in a way he considers clever. He always does them wrong. In handling the Goof, we can take liberties, and animate objects can have more life. They may be exaggerated and humanized when connected with the Goof, as we feel he sees them that way. It took a year or two before animators learned what they could do with Goofy. His gait, his presence, his mannerisms. He was not a leading man like Mickey, but an ace character actor, injecting each scene with new comic sensibility. Goofy reliably messed up whatever he tried to do, but his good nature and optimism kept him lovable. If Mickey was Walt's showman side made flesh, Goofy was the hick hiding inside all country folk who moved to the city. A 1935 edict cemented his physicality. His posture is nil, his back arches the wrong way, and his little stomach protrudes. The description goes on like a comedy roast, describing sagging knees, dainty hands, sloping shoulders, collapsed arches, and flat feet. That Goofy even gets out of bed, much less with a smile on his face, tells you everything you need to know about him. The laugh, the hat, those teeth, the relentlessly upbeat mood. This was a person decades away from cool. Goofy was embarrassing, incorrigible, and perfectly innocent. Just by suffering Goofy's klutziness, Mickey ended up looking loyal, smart, indefatigable, quick on his feet, and not afraid to throw a white-gloved fist. Goofy gave Mickey a new role, The Rock. The classic Goofy cartoons feature a very proper narrator telling the audience the right way to do something, while Goofy demonstrates the exact opposite. It was a brilliant conceit, begun out of necessity because Pinto Colvig was unavailable to voice the character. It worked as ironic humor, the difference between the world in theory and in practice. It also worked as sincere humor, since Goofy does nothing but try to act correctly, which is itself another Goofy irony. One last thing. To quote the kids from the movie Stand By Me, what the hell is Goofy? The book Disney's Dog says, it's best to say that he's that friend of Mickey's with the dog-like features. Bill Farmer, the current voice of Goofy and Pluto, has a better answer. The difference between Goofy and Pluto is that Goofy has a better agent. Considering the ascent of cartoons over the last decade, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, run by Doug Fairbanks, finally decided to start honoring cartoons. Flowers and Trees was a shoo-in to be nominated for the Short Subject Cartoon Award, as was the maudlin Christmas short, Mickey's Orphans. Even back in the 1930s, the Oscars loved a three-hanky show. One of Leon Schlesinger's new Merry Melodies for Warner Brothers rounded out the nominees. To help promote the Oscars and possibly put a white-gloved thumb on the scale, Walt created a 2.5-minute Technicolor cartoon for the occasion, Parade of the Award Nominees. It reused footage from Mother Goose Melodies, but still required a few thousand dollars of pro bono animation. Nominees Mickey and Minnie led the parade, which included hit characters from the year's biggest movies, including Frederick March as Dr. Jekyll, who transforms into Mr. Hyde in front of us. Flowers and Trees won the first cartoon Oscar. Walt also received a special honorary award for creating Mickey Mouse. Walt would win an unbeatable 8 Academy Awards in a row. By his career's end, he would possess 26 Oscars, including 3 more honorary Oscars. They weigh 221 pounds on a scale, more than Walt himself. Walt received many congratulatory telegrams that night. One was from iWork Studios, which would never see an Oscar nomination. iWorks could have been quite snide, inquiring about his half of the Mickey Mouse Oscar. Walt had been disparaging iWorks to the press. iWorks had plodded along, learning the game, and was considered a fair animator, Walt said in 1932 of the man described by everyone else as the greatest. But iWorks took the high road and simply congratulated his old friend. The lines of communication were open again, even if they were of Western Union copper. Reports said Walt appreciated the telegraph almost as much as the little gold man. In 1932, iWorks had been busy experimenting with the next advancement in animation. He built it from a Chevy. The idea came from the old-fashioned stereoscope, which displayed photographs in 3D. The stereoscope's trick, as any turn-of-the-century kid knew, was that the two images on each card were not quite identical. The askew views, when processed through the brain, became three-dimensional. Cartoons had always been in perfect focus. Even if the shot was a panorama or an extreme close-up, it was all cells stacked on a background. This improved on live-action film, which could keep the foreground or background in focus, but usually not both. This imperfect fuzziness had become a part of filmmaking grammar. It was how audiences recognized distances and how they saw their own world. Fuzziness was authenticity. Adding it to a cartoon would make that cartoon seem more real. Iwerks, the camera tinkerer, knew the best way to create the illusion of distance was not to fake it. He mounted a camera on tracks. In the front was a sheet of glass for the cells, and behind that were middle-distance cutouts, like set decorations in a play. Way in the rear was the background itself. The multi-plane camera would create an epic feel for each shot. Unfortunately, Iwerks was a better inventor than a promoter. There should have been press remarks, stories in the newspaper, a special live-action featurette that highlighted the multiplane camera's new effects. Instead, he snuck a few of the special shots into regular cartoons. When the audience failed to burst out into cartwheels, Iwerks quietly gave up on it. Brother, can you spare a dimension? Animators noticed, though. They noticed everything. They took up Ub's slack, seeing the blur and realizing how it must have been created. Within a year, the Fleischers had reverse-engineered intricate multiplane backgrounds for Popeye to cavort in. Humbleness is usually a virtue, but not for a Hollywood producer. Who else is going to trumpet your accomplishment if not you? The multiplane camera was just the next Iwerks advancement to be ignored. For the studio to survive, Iwerks had two options to draw oxygen to his dying fire. One was to do something big with Flip. Newspaper ads featured an Ub Iwerks caricature saying Flip was two jumps ahead in sound cartoon. The other was to go back to color. Iwerks finally started acting like Walt Disney. He chose both. Chapter 25. The Big Bad, 1933. Does it count as taking a page from a competitor if you're merely taking it back? Ub Iwerks was returning to color cartoons, now with the staff and budget to produce them regularly. But he still had a commitment for a monthly Flip the Frog film, which, like Mickey Mouse, would stay black and white. He would devote his time to the color series called Comicolor Cartoons. So he needed the right person to take over for Flip. Iwerks' hands-off style meant whomever he picked would be given a cartoon series on a silver platter. The man Iwerks reached out to was one of the best hands in the business, New York's Myra Natwick. Just as big men are called tiny, Natwick was called grim because of his invariably pleasant mood. He was rangy and handsome, with expressive features. He was also the most gothically named man in animation, until voiceover artist Thurl Ravenscroft. Grimm's claim to fame was creating Betty Boop, who had started as a canine sexpot in a Fleischer Brothers cartoon. Curves were harder to animate than straight lines, but the silver screen had never seen curves like this before. Soon she was being drawn as a human flapper, a walking, talking, shimmying Madonna whore complex. The Fleischer Brothers had been taking credit for Betty's rise to fame. Iwerks understood what that felt like. Receiving credit for his work may have contributed in luring Grimm out west. Iwerks had described the Disney studios as the Cuckoo Hatchery and the Nut House back in the day, and he hoped that Grimm could elevate Iwerks' studio to that level of zaniness. But the Grimm Natwick who had turned a poodle into a pinup did not use his carte blanche on squeaky clean entertainment. Under Grimm's tutelage, Flip became a very risque cartoon. Phones said, damn, when no one picked them up. Hookers snuck out of hotel rooms. Lonely housewives hid cuckolders in closets. A spray of Eau de Pansy perfume turned people effeminate. Women were shown with exposed breasts, and men existed only to be peeping toms. If quality wasn't selling, maybe sex would. Iwerks was 2 years early for the color evolution, and Grimm was 25 years early for the sexual revolution. All the belly-dancing tattoo girls didn't draw positive attention. They didn't even seem to draw negative attention. The Hays Code, a set of censorship guidelines, existed to squash stuff like this. Yet there it was up on screen. Iwerks didn't even merit a lawsuit when he added Disney characters to a Flip the Frog coloring book. Ub Iwerks couldn't get arrested in Hollywood anymore. Irving Wallace shared a story in Collier's that in the 1930s, Mickey Mouse was going to attend Flip the Frog's birthday party, or rather than a woman writing a Mickey diary for Disney decided to write an entry where he visited MGM's famous frog. You've got to kill that line, another Disney publicist said after reading it. Really, you know very well Mickey would never go to anything at MGM, and you know those people at MGM. They might expect a present. Flip was worse than a failure. He was an embarrassment. Iwerks replaced Flip in mid-1933 with Willie Whopper. Willie was a boastful boy whose lies would be illustrated as if they were real. Iwerks' animators practiced drawing Willie by having Flip, in one of his final outings, don a Willie mask for several minutes. Willie's first jaunt would be September's The Air Race, which was loaded with plane gags, an Amelia Earhart cameo, live-action footage of a steam stack collapsing, and a hitchhiking angel who gives pilots the finger. The boss even signed his work via a destroyed fireworks sign that read, I Works. Unfortunately, there were so many air gags, they crowded out the concept of Willie as an unreliable narrator. First episodes of a series, appropriately they're called pilots nowadays, have to establish what audiences will see in each installment. The Air Race failed on that count. MGM refused to show it. This was no problem. Iwerks was nothing if not accommodating. A new 3-minute opening established Willie was racing against his girlfriend's evil landlord, who would evict her family unless Willie wins. Willie also stops to pick up the hitchhiking angel. A blackface gag was cut, as were many of the pre-race plane gags. Most shockingly, the Whopper aspect of Willie is cut entirely. He was now no more special than anyone else. Might as well have been Flip the Frog. Iwerks had become damagingly laissez-faire with his staff. He would say, "You fellows go ahead and do it the way you want," then retire to tinker with electronics. He was becoming the absent-minded tinkerer Walt had accused him of being. His head was apparently so wrapped up in the color world, he rubber-stamped all Willy Whopper suggestions. "Ub shunned responsibility," Ben Sharpstein said. This led to first a frog cartoon becoming a sex romp, and now a cartoon about a liar who was never shown stretching the truth. Iwerks' first Comic-Color cartoon, Jack and the Beanstalk, hit theaters within weeks of the reworked The Air Race, now called Stratosphere. That is, it hit the few theaters that weren't locked into showing Mickey Mouse and silly symphonies. Comic-Color continued Iwerks' post-Disney losing streak. It also continued the emptiness at the core of his well-made stories. Why was Lightning not striking? Why were Oswald and Mickey Boffo but Flip and Willie Lemons? It wasn't character design, but character itself. It was what Walt did with Mickey that was important, not who created him, Ub said to one of his sons. There was nothing special about mice or even Mickey. Disney could have had the same success with a frog or a rabbit or a duck. What mattered was the hand on the tiller. And Ub's alone wasn't enough. Walt, like Ub, needed some new stars. Ace cartoon characters were helped by a few years of background appearances and bit parts before they were given the chance to shine. Finding stars was easier in real life, where actors arrived by the dozens every day to be auditioned. That was Walt's new plan. He had built a live-action studio at Hyperion Avenue and was going to finally become a live-action director. He was in negotiations with United Artists' Mary Pickford to star in a sound remake of the Laugh-O-Gram-era Alice shorts. "I can still recall how awed we were," Walt recalled, "when we figured that it would take $400,000 to $500,000 to do a good job." Walt shot some footage and stills of Mary in costume, including her holding hands with a 3-foot-tall Mickey Mouse doll. Then Paramount released its own Alice in Wonderland movie, with an overstuffed cast that included Cary Grant, Gary Cooper, and W.C. Fields. "That knocked out our ideas," Walt said. Before Alice's demise, Walt had his new in-house composer, Frank Churchill, serenade Mary with a ditty for a new silly symphony. Churchill sang a song called Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf? Written to accompany a possible Three Little Pigs cartoon. Walt wasn't sure whether to finish the cartoon and was looking for advice. The starlet responded in her own straight-shooting style. "If you don't make this cartoon about the pigs, I'll never speak to you again." Pork was back on the menu. Walt's notes for Three Little Pigs stressed Personality, a code word for using the same model sheet for all three pigs. This wasn't cheapness, though. The pigs would act so differently from each other that they'd be distinct creatures despite looking identical. In its own way, personality animation was as new as sound. Imagine cartoon actors actually acting. Good thing he cast Hams. Walt was worried not enough people would appreciate Three Little Pigs' technical advancements. It is not our intention to make a straight story out of this, he stressed. We want to gag it in every way we can and make it as funny as possible. Walt was right. One distributor sniffed that there were only four characters, including the wolf. The idea that more was better was cemented in distributors' heads. Quality was defined as how many moving parts were up on screen. The emphasis on character also led Walt to start what has become a global standard in animation, marrying animator to character. Match the personality of the animators to the role. Instead of distributing shots at random, assign the guy who excelled at dancing the dancing shots, and the guy who excelled at villains the wolf. Upon its release, Three Little Pigs became a huge hit. It beat a Mickey for the Oscar that year. Walt almost didn't attend. He was stuck with an eye patch due to a polo injury. But host Will Rogers insisted. Rental fees the first year were almost 10 times the Toon's $15,700 budget. One theater started drawing longer and longer beards on its poster of the pigs, representing how long they'd been continuously playing. It was probably the most viewed piece of film in cinema's history. Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf? So many people sang Big Old Wolf as Big Bad Wolf that Frank Churchill changed the lyrics, became one of the biggest ditties of 1933. It stayed on the Billboard charts for 2 months, which must have pleased Carl Stalling, now a freelancer who performed it. Clark Gable sang it the next year in It Happened One Night. 30 years later, Edward Albee parried it as Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Kay Kamen lost a boatload of money on Three Little Pigs by not having sheet music ready after it premiered. From that, he took the lesson to never underestimate demand. After the pigs, Kamen basically doubled his merchandise. Each item was now available in Mickey and Three Little Pigs versions. The selection of Falderall grew so immense, it had to be listed in a Sears-style catalog. Other marketers were copying Kamen's strategies. In 1933, a literary agent bought the merchandising rights to Tarzan and Winnie the Pooh, both still established brands, and both now associated with Disney. Alley-Oop, Lil Abner, Buck Rogers. If it was popular, it was a merchandising goldmine for someone. As grand as Mickey had been for Disney, 800,000 fan letters in 1933 alone, he hadn't yet entered the national conversation about the Great Depression. But the pigs did. They reflected the inaugural statement of new President Franklin Roosevelt. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. This Gadzook's optimism was reflected in the song's lyrics, which share the stubborn refusal to be afraid. Yes, the economy was a big bad wolf, and we were mere livestock. But if the pigs could survive, so could the nation. That's a lot to attribute to a cartoon. The real world regularly affected cartoons. Walter Lantz had Oswald the Lucky Rabbit head to Washington, D.C. to get a syringe full of confidence from FDR to fight a villain called Depression. But it was ludicrous to suggest that Disney drawings could make a true difference in the world. Right? Clowns were not preachers. Entertainment was not faith. Your 20th century everyman still needed gods, but they looked to Hollywood for them now. In certain shopping centers, kids wanted to see Mickey Mouse more than Santa. Mickey's familiar outline fit into the religion-shaped hole in the hearts of America. Hard times were even hitting the Odeons. Almost a third of movie theaters were shuttered by 1933. Disney, meanwhile, saw a spike in revenues during FDR's bank holidays. The success of Three Little Pigs helped Walt finance a new hobby, something only Hollywood hoi polloi could afford. Polo. It was especially haughty to do so during the Depression, but the sport let Walt schmooze, so he bought 6 ponies and press-ganged some of his upper echelon men to ride with him. "It's my only sin," he told his mother in a letter. I don't gamble or go out and spend money on other men's wives or anything like that. So I guess it's okay. Anyway, the wife approves of it. The wife would not have much errant time on her hands. Lily was pregnant. Diane Mary Disney was born in December via cesarean. Lily would never bear another child. Walt almost missed the birth because he was, as coincidence would have it, receiving an award from a parenting magazine. He and Lily were older parents, but they were finally parents. To celebrate, Walt bought his infant daughter a pony. Walt would become an admirable father, dropping Diane off at school, taking her on outings, and doing various other tasks most studio heads and many on his own staff hired others to do. A second daughter, Sharon, was adopted 3 years later. Walt allowed them to live ordinary private lives. His kids would never be props to hawk their old man's cartoons. This was more than just wisdom. It was prudence. The Lindbergh baby tragedy had been just the year before. Mickey Mouse's 5-year anniversary was in 1933. Instead of wood or silverware, the media centers of the day gave the gift of glowing retrospectives. Screenland, the Mouse Solini of geniuses. The Los Angeles Times, he is little David who slays Goliath. He is that most popular because most universally conceivable hero, the little man who shuts his eyes and pastes the big bully in the jaw. The Boston American, he came to us at the time the country needed him most, at the beginning of the Depression. He has helped us laugh away our troubles, forget our creditors, and keep our chins up. The Albany Evening News, when the last plaintive moan of the Depression has faded, give some thanks to a Mr. Walter Disney. Just as the pigs represented FDR's determination, Mickey was now the embodiment of brio. Walt summed it up in 3 words. He is youth. Just as a heart symbol represents love, Mickey was coming to personify optimism, exuberance, the primal passions that changed the world. Previous generations invoked saints or martyrs. This generation invoked a cartoon. Mickey Mouse had become the god of childhood. Gods need houses of worship. Museum patrons in Milwaukee, Philadelphia, and Toledo, Ohio in 1933 saw a touring exhibit called The Art of Mickey Mouse. The word art was not used sarcastically. Mickey exhibits would become touring attractions, a spoonful of sugar that drew millions into highbrow galleries. Mickey hit the air in another format as well. David Sarnoff's RCA broadcast a test image of Mickey Mouse on electronic television in 1933. Gods need disciples. Each frame of Mickey was the work of dozens of hands, collaborating in concert, crafting the vision of their small-town boy made good. Their work was creative enough to be cherished, yet cookie-cutter enough to line up with the library of past appearances. Gods need followers. A religion without quorum is just a cult, after all. That was where mass media came in. 100 articles, 1,000 viewings, 1,000,000 conversations a year were turning Mickey Mouse into a household name. He was a creed-free, pluralistic spirituality. All were welcome. Gods need a gospel. Mickey would have 64 cartoons out by end of 1933, each preaching a variant of the same message. As with most holy books, Mickey offered not direct commandments, but parables. Whether he was building a robot boxer, battling air pirates, or putting on a show, Mickey's enthusiasm saves the day. Disney commissioned a film historian to write a long dissection of a recent Mickey, The Steeplechase, to see what made Mickey tick. But kids already knew the answer. He never gave up. One other thing those Mickeys had in common was they premiered in the comic strip first. Floyd Gottfredson was Mickey's test pilot, trying out unsure stories. Mickey as a newspaper editor. Mickey buys an elephant. Mickey versus a submarine. If these apocryphal trial balloons went over well, they might make it to the canonical big screen. If not, it saved $10,000. In print and on screen, Mickey was now a straight man. In vaudeville, the straight men got paid more because it was tougher to be on the receiving end of a cream pie. Mickey still went on wild adventures, but he no longer instigated chaos. This led to a dilemma. The unmovable object needed an unstoppable force to go up against. No one wants a Felix Unger one-man show. Mickey had become a walking wet blanket. The previous year, Walt had started a Disney night school. This year, he was going to have the night school veterans teach the newbies. With that, the last vestiges of raucous, oscillating iWork style would be flushed away. What came out of the studio would look twice as good as before, albeit at maybe 10 times the expense. If all other cartoon makers were building their cartoons with stick and straw, Walt's had been built with brick. Disney cartoons lasted. Chapter 26, Duck Season, 1934. On a hot July night in Chicago, the manager of the Biograph Theater worried that robbers were milling outside his box office. He called the police. They discovered the skulkers were G-men. The FBI was hunting John Dillinger, who was inside. Dillinger was a movie buff. He came with 2 lady friends to take in a Mickey Mouse short, then a Clark Gable gangster film called Manhattan Melodrama. He may have also wanted to hear some surreptitious applause for his bank robbing antics. A Detective magazine survey of theater owners found Gentleman Jack got more newsreel applause than any other person or mouse. The last thing Dillinger heard that evening, though, was gunfire. He died on the sidewalk after being shot in the back by a fed. MGM tastelessly hyped Manhattan Melodrama as Dillinger's last movie. The Biograph Theater made a big deal out of it as well, running a navel-gazing newsreel that focused on events 20 feet away. But Dillinger's scoop was second on the Biograph's marquee. Mickey Mouse still got top billing over morbid curiosity. Disney, of course, made not a peep. It did not want to get within a country mile of America's biggest crook. Dillinger's popularity was due to his brazenness about living by his own moral code. That was uncomfortably close to what people loved about Mickey. But the wild Mickey of Plain Crazy was not the mouse of 1934. Children's musician Frank Luther was recording novelty songs featuring Mickey and Minnie. Mickey started showing up in a full-page feature in Good Housekeeping magazine and collected a big payday to appear on Post Toasties boxes. A company was selling shortened, silent versions of early Mickey cartoons for home viewing. How much more domesticated could he get? 5 years of accumulated choices had led to Mickey's consistent, balanced personality. Fun-loving but responsible, imaginative but grounded, emotional but clear-eyed. He was a ringleader, a bandleader, a toastmaster, a mensch. He was Walt. Well, Walt on his good days. But there was a downside to the Walt-Mickey bonding. Ever since Julius the Cat, Disney had been telling stories about likable troublemakers. That was not Mickey anymore, and his beige-on-beige stories reflected it. Spicing Mickey up was out of the question. Walt joked he wasn't to blame for the de-zesting. If our gang ever put Mickey in a situation less wholesome than Sunshine, Mickey would take Minnie by the hand and move to some other studio. Mickey was a hero, a friend, a mouse pure of heart, and all wet as a comedy star. What Disney needed wasn't a sob story, but an SOB. A live wire, a powder keg, a loud mouth. Someone more like Walt on his bad days. An irrational, demanding bully everyone was scared to see marching down the hall. Goofy was too mild-mannered. Horace too petard-hoistable. Clarabelle and Old Biddy. And Minnie too sensible. A new character would have to fit the bill. And, as it so happened, he came with a bill. Enter a West Coast funny man named Clarence Nash. Nash traveled to gigs in a miniature milk wagon pulled by miniature horses. One of his bits was bird impressions, which he did on a popular L.A. radio show called The Merrymakers. His closer was a duck reciting, "Mary Had a Little Lamb." Surprisingly, as of 1934, there were no famous ducks. Other than a supporting role in Crazy Cat, the only prominent waterfowl was Beatrix Potter's Jemima Puddle Duck. Ducks have been cornerstones of jokes for decades. A 2002 survey found the duck the world's funniest animal. Ducks deserve to be in comedy. If for no other reason than the puns, such as that fit the bill joke two paragraphs ago. The merry